Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations present Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells.
It was a landmark event in radio history, broadcast on KIRO AM 80 years ago this week, the 1938 panic-inducing broadcast of The War of the Worlds. Felix Bunnell is here to tell us about it, brought to us by the King County Library System.
Are you panicking yet, Dave, about portraying Orson Welles tomorrow night in the show?
Not yet.
Okay.
I haven't seen the script yet. I've listened to it again, but
I'll send it to you again. It was the evening of Sunday, October 30th, 1938. The show was broadcast 8 p.m. Eastern Time, which is 5 p.m. Pacific Time. Source material was H.G. Wells' 1898 story about a Martian attack on England. Orson Welles and scriptwriter Howard Koch updated the story. They set it in New Jersey, and they presented it as mostly as a series of news bulletins and live official broadcasts. This was brilliant because just a month earlier, live radio had covered the Munich crisis for much of September. This is when Hitler had moved to occupy part of Czechoslovakia, and Great Britain interceded, and it looked like Europe was headed to war. This is one of the first times a radio began to really come into its own as something very different from a newspaper by presenting live news and analysis as the news was happening. That was radically new back then. You know the old "we interrupt this program for a news bulletin" cliche. Yeah. In September of 1938, the cliche was "we interrupt this bulletin to bring you a program." Researchers figured about 6 million people heard the show, and of those, about 1 million were fooled at some point into believing it might be real. I've been spending a lot of time studying the original recording, listening to it over and over again and studying it, and I have a couple samples from that original show that I think show why it was so scary. For me, it all comes down to the power of silence and the realism of crummy music. The spookiness begins in the middle of a live broadcast of dance music from a hotel, and this was a staple of radio back in the 30s to fill the hours of the evening with a live broadcast from hotels. So we begin by listening to Ramon Raquello and his orchestra from the Hotel Park Plaza in downtown New York.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars. The spectroscope indicates the gas to be hydrogen and moving toward the Earth with enormous velocity. Professor Pearson of the observatory at Princeton confirms Farrell's observation and describes the phenomenon as, quote, like a jet of blue flame shot from a gun, unquote. We now return you to the music of Ramon Raquello, playing for you in the Meridian Room of the Park Plaza Hotel, situated in downtown New York.
And that's Bernard Herrmann, who later composed the Psycho theme. That's him conducting the orchestra and purposely sounding like a bad hotel orchestra in New York in the 1930s.
Yeah.
And the gaps of silence when the music stops and the voice comes in, and the voice stops, the music comes in, the silence is what really makes the show scary. And later there's piano interludes between these bits because radio stations in the 30s oftentimes had a piano player just sitting there to fill in the dead air between the programs where they couldn't control the run times and they would just fill in for, 10 seconds or a couple minutes.
Right.
But later they go out to a live report from commentator Carl Phillips. They didn't call him radio reporters yet back then. They called them commentators. And he's joining us by a special mobile unit out there in Grover's Mill, New Jersey. And this actor, Carl Reddick, had studied the recording from a year earlier of the Hindenburg crash, where this guy named Herb Morrison describes this very mundane thing of this thing landing.
Humanity.
Yeah, exactly. So this is Carl Phillips with a person on the street talking to a farmer out in Grover's Mill, New Jersey.
Mr. Wilmot. Would you please tell the radio audience as much as you remember of this rather unusual visitor that dropped in your backyard? A step closer, please. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Mr. Wilmot.
Well, I was listening to the radio.
Closer and louder, please.
Pardon me?
Louder, please, closer.
Yes. I was listening to the radio and kind of drowsing. A professor fellow was talking about Mars, so I was half chosen and half...
Yes, yes, Mr. Wilmot, and then what happened?
Well, as I was saying, I was listening to the radio... Kind of halfway.
Yes, Mr. Willett. And then you saw something.
Well, not first off. I heard something.
And what did you hear?
A hissing sound like this.
The interesting thing to me is this. So this is an eyewitness who had been listening to the radio broadcast that he is now a part of.
Exactly. Very meta.
How did they get the remote out to Grover's Mills, New Jersey that quickly?
You bring up a very good point. What a lot of the people who panicked at the show, they missed the compression of time that happened.
Yeah.
The world is destroyed in about 45 minutes if you pay close attention. And they're giving times of, this is happening at 9:30 Eastern time. And it's still like 8:30 Eastern time if you look at your clock. So you had to really suspend disbelief, which... in the 1930s, maybe people were more likely to suspend disbelief. But around here, an actual panic took hold up in Concrete on off of Highway 20 there in Skagit County. This is what was played on the radio during the show, right about 8:35 or so.
A bulletin is handed me. Martian cylinders are falling all over the country. One outside of Buffalo, one in Chicago, St. Louis. Seem to be timed in space.
So that's about 5:30 time Pacific time, that 5:35 p.m. Pacific time. That's a reporter who's supposed to be on the roof of the broadcast house in New York. And right then, up in Skagit County in Concrete, the power went out. And people literally ran through the streets. It's one of the few documented episodes of where there was another circumstance that made the panic much more real.
Wow.
And about 15 years ago, when I was working on for a public radio station, I tracked down one of the few eyewitnesses. And this is what Albert Frank saw as he came driving into town.
We were coming home from Everett. We hit into Concrete about the time that lightning and thunderstorm hit, and people were kind of wandering around and yelling and screaming. We couldn't figure out what was going on. Here comes this woman out of the house there yelling that the world was coming to an end. And we tried to stop her and grab her, and finally we got her into the Eagles, and she was quite yelling and screaming yet.
And the local paper up there, the Concrete Herald, published editorials about how embarrassed they were and describing everything, other things that went on. A lot of the other panic episodes described were hype and didn't really happen. People, nobody killed themselves. Nobody jumped out of a building or anything like that. But my favorite footnotes to the story is that radio was always more popular on the West Coast than any other part of the country. 1937, 95% of homes on the West Coast had radios. In the East Coast, only 92% of homes had radios. We always loved radio more in the West, and we were more willing to believe that if Martians were coming and the radio told us to run through the streets, we should go ahead and do that. So join us. If you want to panic, join us tomorrow night for the big show with you doing the role of Professor Pearson through the filter of Orson Welles.
Yeah. So we're gonna do it. Are you going to do exactly the same way as the original broadcast, or are you updating it at all?
The script is exactly the same. Some of the technology will be different, and of course it's different actors, and it will sound different on FM radio, but we're just going to do the spirit of it and the letter and intent as much as we can.
I know that midway through the broadcast, the original broadcast, I mean the CBS switchboard lit up.
Yeah.
And one of the broadcast executives went into the studio and ordered Orson Welles to do a disclaimer saying what you're listening to is a drama.
Well, they had a regular station break built in at about 40 minutes past that they did. And a lot of those stories about what happened in New York, a lot of that is hype because this helped Orson Welles elevate to Hollywood status.
Yeah.
And a few months later, he heads off to Hollywood.
And he
to
was
start
like,
doing
what, 26?
23. He was just a kid, yeah. And John Houseman was involved, too. So it's a bunch of – and Howard Koch, who wrote the script, won the Oscar a few years later for Casablanca.
Felix Bunnell, brought to you each Wednesday by the King County Library System. So it is October 24th, which means we're approaching the third anniversary of the latest homelessness emergency in Seattle. Kyra's Hannah Scott is here. She's been following up on this. And the latest idea was the giant tent to house people. So what's the status of that?
So there's a lot going on there. First of all, we're in the middle of the entire budget process for the city. So there's the city council has been going over, pouring through the mayor's proposed budget. And there's been several meetings as well as public hearings. Now, last night was the last public hearing held for this budget cycle for the public to have a chance to say what they wanted to say. And the sense of urgency needed to address the city's homeless crisis was clear at that nearly 5-hour public hearing last night from those lobbying to restore funding for the Wheel Women's Shelter.
Our city is a public health disaster. Until there's housing for all, we need shelter in the meantime. Please restore the Wheel Shelter funding. Women need it to feel safe. They need it to keep warm and rest. Without it, where are broken women going to turn? Shelter is not a want, it's a need. And we need you, City of Seattle, to restore the funding for this life-saving shelter. This isn't just the homeless community's problem, it's all of our problem.
And there were staff from the city's main downtown shelter stressing the need for a pay raise to end the turnover of qualified staff at these shelters.
The decisions that we make in that environment are literally life and death. I've had people die in my arms. I know that the people that I have kicked out of the shelter at night, that I have turned down for a bed in the morning, have gone out and commit suicide, that they have froze to death at night, that they are no longer with us for one reason or another. And the decisions that we make in homeless shelters, they're not minimum wage decisions.
What was the issue with the women's shelter?
Sharon Wheel of Lost... a lot of their funding in this proposed budget from the mayor. There's the women's shelter is low barrier, so I think that the mayor as a whole is moving away from those type of things. This is a tent shelter,
So what's the, I mean? They feel there's a better way to do this. Is that what they're saying?
That's kind of what the mayor's office is saying. Yeah, they're moving away from that model. But that woman that you just heard from there, this is the only
Well, what I'm trying to
shelter.
Figure out is, I mean, in the effort to improve homeless services. They're going to close down one of these shelters. So where do those people end up? Does that mean they go back to sleeping in doorways, or is there a better place for them to go?
Well, the better way, if you talk to anyone in the city right now, is enhanced shelters. We're trying to move everybody into these
enhanced shelters. So do they have those enhanced shelters?
We do have enhanced shelters, but at any given time, I believe the estimates are that there's anywhere from 3 to 10 of those beds available on any given night. Also, those are not low
that's
barrier.
Not very many.
It's not enough. We need more. So that's part of this whole budget conversation. What do we do? How do we get the money to build more of these so we can get all of these people out of these models that aren't working and into these models of enhanced shelters, which again, 24/7, you have your laundry, you have your case management, and they get more people into the exit into permanent housing is what they are better at, those enhanced shelters, than some of these tents. So that's all being discussed. One of the other things being discussed is the vehicle response, right? What do we do about all the people living in their vehicles? There is a proposal from the mayor for $250,000 for what's known as a safe parking lot. It's being hammered out. What it doesn't include, though, is RVs.
It's a good step in the right direction, but RVs are part of the problem that are driving neighbors nuts, and I don't think we've come up with anything yet. I think we need to really have a focus on what can we do? And where can we provide space for people that have the pump outs and the hand washing and all of that available? I think it's good and it's great, and I applaud the executive for having these places for people who are living in their car, but it isn't anywhere near enough.
So that's Sally Bagshaw talking about the mayor's proposal. It sounds like Human Services wants to go after some models in Santa Barbara and San Diego, where they have these safe lots, again, with case management. They exclude RVs, though, so expect that to come up more in the budget process, where the council might do some additions involving RVs. Also borrowing from ideas in California is Councilmember Teresa Mosqueda, who officially unveiled her proposal for a massive tent to house 75 to 100 people based on models she saw in L.A. over the summer. Now, Mosqueda says while permanent housing is the solution, there's not enough of it right now, and we need to have bridge shelter system to get as many people off the streets as possible while they wait for housing.
When I went to Los Angeles, I saw a model that allows for us to quickly erect a possible tent and allow for up to 75 to 100 people to stay inside with partitions between the beds, with case managers on site, with the ability to do this in a relatively quick manner on vacant properties, on properties that are currently being used as parking lots or maybe being used to store materials as we wait to build.
So she is officially proposing a $3 million ask for 2019 to erect one of these tents that, again, houses 75 to 100. That covers the cost, by the way, of putting up the tent. It does not cover the $2 million needed to operate the tent. So we'll see if that is added to this budget. So the council is going through what the mayor proposed. Later this week, they'll start making their edits and what they want to get done as they reconcile that. We'll see if the tent makes it in there. Not everyone was on board. Lorena Gonzalez thought maybe that money would be better spent on more enhanced shelter beds like we talked about.
Kyra is Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Time for our Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is, Danny O'Neill. I have just one footnote from the WSU-Oregon game. The swinging gate play, which is apparently a trick play, and here's how it went down.
Look where the ball is. We're swinging the gate. We're swinging the gate, Timmy. And there it goes. Boogie Williams trying to get outside. And goes. Stays with it. Boogie! He is there, Boogie! Touchdown.
Swinging gate leading to the touchdown. What is the swinging gate play?
Where the center who snaps the ball is lined up separate from what would conventionally be seen as the rest of the offensive line.
So he's not really in the center?
No, he's not in the middle at all. In fact, usually he's dramatically off to the side, or the rest of the offensive linemen are dramatically
off to the side. Wouldn't that lineup tip the other team to what they're about to do?
Well, it forces a decision. Do you want to be on top of the ball, which is where the defensive line usually is, which in this case would be one guy. And you could put three people there and know that you could storm him, right? You got three guys to his one. The problem is the bulk of the manpower, both the blockers and the skill position players, are on a different part of the field. So provided the guy who's snapping the ball can snap it that distance, you're then moving the ball to...
He snaps it sideways?
That diagonally, correct.
He snaps it diagonally.
But yeah. From in front of him. He doesn't go through his legs.
From in front of him.
And he throws
he doesn't
it.
Even snap it through his legs?
No, on this particular play, you can snap
so
it
you
between
can do
your
anything.
Legs, but on this one, he basically throws an underhanded pass.
Did you know you could do that?
I did not know you could snap that way.
There are rules. The center's hips have to stay parallel to
correct.
The line of scrimmage. He can't pivot when the
wow.
play starts. He can't be lined up diagonally.
So this is why they want footballers to take ballet, because this is very technical.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that, but it's also... It forces the defense to a decision.
Yeah.
And that's really what you're trying to do, is you're trying to get them to tip their hand. Are you going to load up on the side where all the offensive linemen and the skill position players are? Or are you going to put more guys... Where are you going to put your advantage? Because every team pretty much... The defense usually has plus one, because whoever gets the snap, if it's the quarterback, is not really a threat to run.
Yeah.
So where are you going to put your extra defender?
Okay, but if anything goes on the snap, which I was not aware of until now, why do they most of the time just do the same old thing, which everybody's ready for? Why don't they just do it completely differently each time they snap the ball?
Well, in this case, because doing it the way everybody's prepared for, you've got five guys who are bigger and able to fend off the raving hordes of defensive players that are on the other side. And it you've got a little bit of a strength there that you can reasonably expect a certain amount of time before the aforementioned raving hordes yeah. come blitzing through the line of scrimmage. When you start changing that configuration, it's less reliable. It's less predictable. If you've got fewer offensive linemen, the possibility that someone's going to come storming through there is greater. It forces the defense to make a decision about resource allocation.
Let me ask you this. What actually formally starts the play? When you say hike? When you move the ball?
No, it's when you move the ball.
So when you move the ball. You have to say anything then?
No. That's
so why do they give audible counts? Why does the guy just sort of say, oh, I wonder if I'll snap the bam?
Well, have you heard people refer to a hard count?
Yeah.
That's when somebody is saying the word that they've been using to trigger the snap in an effort to get the defense to jump off sides. Because they're saying, okay, we've been doing this for the last eight plays. Mm. Now we're going to say that, and I'm going to say it really hard. I'm going to say it loud, like, hut!
Is there a formula for calling those trick plays? Because remember when the Seahawks did the touchdown with John Ryan? Got to send my love to John Ryan for that one. And that was really special. It was unexpected, this and that. When do you call a special play like that, a trick play?
Well, it depends. You have to notice something in the defense that makes you think it's going to work.
So it's not like when the game is close and you really need that tricky touchdown?
You can, but you're going to call that at a point where you think you've got the advantage. Mm. You've noticed a tendency that they tend to do, whether it's a player not honoring a certain assignment that he should have, or you note a vulnerability. It also depends upon your coach's guts.
And that's what makes this one so interesting. You see the swinging gate primarily used quite often on extra points, right near the goal line, or field goals really close, because you can get an easy deuce, easy 2 points, if they don't put the right amount of guys around the center.
See how he translated
for us. But when Leach did this on like the 35 or 40 yard line, that was just genius. I mean, it's you don't normally see it there, and it worked tremendously.
It did, but this play didn't score because of the swinging gate.
Well, they missed eight tackles. That was also
that's
a problem.
It was an extraordinary... Like, that's not how the swinging gate is supposed to work, because all of a sudden, Booby Williams is running through an entire defense.
The other way, by the way, from the other side
correct.
Of strength.
He ran behind the guy that was the snapper who wasn't supposed to be the strength of the blocking.
Okay. Well, I vote for more weird plays regardless. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon. Keep your gate closed.
Yeah, okay. I'll try my best. Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealer. It was a shocking accusation that kept Bellevue Police Chief Steve Milette off the job. For nearly 3 months, he was cleared of rape allegations this week after investigators found that his accuser lied and fabricated evidence. Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott talked with the chief this morning about that ordeal. Hannah?
Dave, it was an accusation Chief Milette never saw coming. He was accused of rape by a woman who said the two had met on a bondage website, and she claimed Milette had gone further than the two agreed upon by having sex with her when they met for an in-person encounter she said happened at his home in Bothell. He was placed on leave, and Bothell police conducted a nearly three-month investigation that wrapped up this week. The finding? Milette and this woman had never even met. as he always maintained, and that the woman had made everything up and manufactured evidence to support the false rape allegation. For Milette, the ordeal is over. He is now back on the job, but it certainly took a toll. He says he'll never forget the day he learned of the allegations.
I'm in shock. Why? I'm trying to figure out how this could have happened, because I have no connection to this individual. I've never met her, never been around her, never spoken with her.
And it only got more bizarre from there.
When I found out the extent that she went to in order to make it appear that I had a relationship with her and, you know, to demonstrate through evidence that I committed this crime, I quite frankly, I was shocked at the length that she went to basically frame me for something I didn't do.
Milette says talking to his family about this and what he was being accused of was very difficult, but that he was lucky.
I'm very blessed and I'm very fortunate that I married Joanne 28 years ago, and she and I are very, very close. We're each other's best friend, and we know each other better than we probably know ourselves. So I knew that my wife would never suspect that I would ever violate my marriage vows or that I'm capable of committing, you know, this crime.
And he was right. His family stayed strong and right by his side throughout this entire ordeal. The allegations against him were so outrageous, the chief expected the investigation to wrap up quickly. But because of the great lengths that the woman went to manufacture evidence against him, the investigation took much longer, with DNA tests, polygraphs, and forensic analysis of phones and computers. During those long 3 months, Milette was incredibly concerned about the safety and security he's provided for his family because it was in jeopardy.
A lot of things could have happened here. You know, the city could have turned around and said, hey, look, you know, we're not willing to take the risk. We're releasing you. This thing could have gone in a different direction. She could have fabricated evidence that would have been hard to refute. I had to have these conversations with Joanne and my kids in order to prepare for the worst case scenario.
But he always knew he was innocent, and his faith helped him through, along with his confidence in the Bothell Police Department. As for what he thinks should happen to his accuser, a woman who not only falsely accused him, but others as well.
I believe that people should be held accountable for their actions. And I think the accuser should be held accountable for her actions. I'm not seeking vengeance. That's not me. Pray for those who persecute you. And I've been trying. I'm not perfect on things, but I'm working on it. But she should be held accountable.
Milette says it was important that this accusation and all similar accusations be investigated thoroughly and taken seriously, regardless of what the outcome is. And he hopes one woman's false claim here does not discourage those who actually have been victimized of reporting what happened to them. Asked whether this has tarnished his reputation.
I hope not. I hope not.
Wow. So what will happen to this woman?
Last check, I talked to the prosecutor. They are reviewing the case that was sent over to them from Bothell PD. They've expanded that to look into this woman and whether they will file any possible charges against her regarding these false accusations and manufacturing evidence is something that could be decided as early as next week.
Why is there any question about that? I mean, it's now been verified that this was false.
So this isn't the only one. This is, again, that very complicated case that involved multiple officers over at Bellevue PD. One that the woman had a relationship with, who it appears was guilty of some sort of domestic violence issue with her, but who she also manufactured evidence against later on when she claimed that he had violated a no contact order. So she lost all credibility there. In that particular case, the prosecutors declined to file any charges for her for fabricating evidence in that case.
Why?
Because of concerns about her mental health.
Well, I'm sorry, but whether you're ill or not, you can't go around ruining people's reputations. And I realize, okay, I'm speaking as a man here, but also this tends to discredit other women who come forward. You can point at this case and say, well, how do we know that she didn't make it up?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, unless you pursue this, I'm sorry about the mental illness, but you even mentally ill or not, you can't be out on the loose doing this kind of thing to innocent people.
Absolutely, and I would be surprised if there's not some charges here. Again, this is a woman who in 2009 and 2010 also falsely accused two other people of rape. I don't believe there was manufacturing of evidence there, but at least two cases now where they say she's manufactured evidence. So we'll see. I'll keep you up to date when I find out next week.
Hannah Scott, thanks, Hannah.
You bet.
Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien.
Now, aside from the caravan of migrants dominating the conversation around the midterms right now, healthcare is still up there as a major issue on voters' minds as they cast their ballots. Julie Rovner is the senior health correspondent for Kaiser Health News, also the host of the podcast, What the Health. And Julie, I want to start by talking about what's at stake for healthcare the next time Congress convenes, because it could be a very different Congress.
That's right. It could be. And there are many health issues at stake. The Republicans, if they preserve their majority and even perhaps add in the Senate, might try again to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. The Democrats are making a big issue of protections for pre-existing conditions because those could, in theory, go away even without any further acts of Congress because there's a lawsuit that's challenging them right now in the federal court.
This always just makes my head spin when we talk about health care, and I try to really boil it down to, okay, what does that mean for somebody who might have employer health care? What does that mean for somebody who has private insurance through the marketplace?
Well, very few people actually buy their own insurance, and that's mostly what we're talking about. It's at any one point in time, it's probably 17, 18 million people. However, people who have employer insurance often pass through that individual market. They're between jobs. They have a child who gets off of the parents' health insurance. It used to be when they graduated college. Now it's at age 26. So there are times when people find themselves needing to buy their own insurance, and that's what we're talking about. We're talking about if you have a pre-existing health condition, whether or not you'll be able to get your own insurance and you'll be able to afford the price that's charged. And those are the two things, the big things that the Affordable Care Act changed. It said that insurers must sell to people with pre-existing conditions and they must not charge them more. That's generally been true in employer insurance for quite some time, but it had never been true in the individual market before. And I think so, even people who aren't in the individual market but are worried that someday they might be, if you retire early and need to buy your own insurance to tide you over until you qualify for Medicare, those are people who are all concerned that someday they might need to buy insurance and they want to make sure that they'll be able to.
And I did a double take the other day, I think it was last week, when the president said the Democrats want to take away the pre-existing condition mandate. And I thought, well, that doesn't sound right, because it's always been the opposite messaging from Democrats about Republicans. So who exactly is in control, or who is for and against the pre-existing conditions mandate?
Well, of course, now everybody says that they're for protections for pre-existing conditions. Republicans, however, have voted repeatedly to take them away, including as recently as 2017. So this current Congress, it's just that it's become more popular as an issue with the public. The president, of course, has done things to the Affordable Care Act that would undermine those protections for pre-existing conditions. And in fact, in the lawsuit I mentioned, the president's own Justice Department is arguing for the elimination of the pre-existing condition protections. So the president is kind of saying one thing and doing another.
And if Democrats take one House or both after the midterms, what are they promising on the health care front?
Well, Democrats, if they take only one House, or even if they take both houses of Congress, but they still won't have the presidency, won't be able to do very much. But what they would be able to do is block the Republicans from doing further what they consider damage to the Affordable Care Act or damage to the healthcare system. It's possible that Democrats and Republicans could work together on issues where there's a little bit less partisan disagreement. Drug prices is one. There's been some effort to at least try to figure out around the edges how to stop drug prices from going up, if not bring them down, and the opioid epidemic. And we'll have a really big, robust debate in anticipation of 2020.
Julie Rovner is the senior health correspondent for Kaiser Health News, also the host of the podcast, What the Health. Julie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. I'm Carolyn Osorio. The American Cancer Society was established in 1913 by 10 doctors and 5 businessmen in New York City. Today, it is one of the oldest and largest volunteer health organizations. When the American Cancer Society opened their doors, the goal was to raise awareness about cancer. Back then, it caused so much fear and denial, it was considered inappropriate to even say the word cancer in public because it was seen as a death sentence. Even now, Christina Kelly from the American Cancer Society says the organization still battles every day to change that perception.
People hear those words, you have cancer. They go home, and then suddenly they're flooded with all kinds of questions that they didn't ask, because just the shock of hearing those words sometimes, you know, just takes them for a loop. So we have a phone line that they can call 24/7, and they can ask questions. And oftentimes, if they don't get the exact answer they're looking for, you know, we'll get those answers and help them. In addition to that, we provide patient navigators, just going through the maze of insurance and all the appointments you have to have. And it's just overwhelming after you've had that kind of diagnosis. And so some of the hospitals have patient navigators to help them through some of the maze of insurance papers, or keeping track of when they have to be at a certain place at a certain time, you know, and just checkup appointments. So those navigators are a lifeline to the patient.
In 1928, the famous sword symbol logo was designed with two serpents forming the handle to represent both the scientific and medical focus of the society's mission.
Right now, our big emphasis is early detection, because with all the new technology we have out there, you know, 3D mammograms, we can detect cancer earlier. And if we detect it earlier, your chances of survival go, you know, skyrocket. So that's where we're looking at right now, is trying to get those screenable cancers where someone comes in and we can test for lung cancer, breast cancer, cervical cancer, prostate cancer. Those are the kinds of screenable cancers that we can catch early.
And over 100 years later, that research has produced one vaccination from your pediatrician, which means your kids will never have to worry about six types of cancer.
We now know that if you vaccinate your 11 and 12-year-old boys and girls with the HPV vaccination, in their lifetime, they will never see six cancers. Never. Our goal has been to eliminate cancer.
Part of what I've read that the American Society does is that they have public health advertising campaigns. I saw public health advertising campaigns with the HPV virus so effective. I mean, I get my kids their regular treatments anyway, but the, you know, the kid just kind of looks up and was like, you know, thanks.
Did you know?
Yeah.
Guilt.
But it works. It's effective. In fact, not only is it guilt, but it's the kind of guilt that provides hope. Like you said, if you get this HPV vaccine, that's six cancers you don't have to worry about.
Never have to worry about. And it's to me, it's a no-brainer.
And the blade of the sword symbol expresses the crusading spirit of the cancer movement. So for that person that's sitting out there in their car listening to this, how can they get involved? Or how do you reach them to want to know more about American Cancer Society, want to know about maybe they have been putting off getting a screening that because maybe they don't have a network of family to help support? I mean, when you go and get the screenings, you know you got to deal with whatever comes of that, good or bad.
Everyone knows someone who's had cancer or battled it. Well, if it's not you personally, it could be your family members, your colleagues, your neighbors. This is not a disease that discriminates. What I do when I do a fundraiser, like, I know that I'm banking dollars for my future. I'm banking dollars for your kids. I'm banking dollars knowing that when we raise those funds, somebody's going to get saved. I heard Jesse Jones from, who's a broadcaster.
Yeah, our news partner, Cairo 7 TV.
Yeah, I heard Jesse Jones say recently at a fundraiser, you know, I don't know if it's your dollar or my dollar or your dollar, but all those dollars start to add up. And when somebody gives up a latte a week, or maybe even two lattes a week, that adds up. All those $1 will add up. And it's the research that keeps me alive, because he has stage 4 cancer. And he is being kept alive through what we do, the kind of work we do. You're going to know people who have cancer, and it could be somebody very close to you. And so that's the reason, if you're sitting in your car and listening, that's the reason you get involved.
Christina Kelly, Director of Communications, the Washington Chapter of American Cancer Society, thank you so much for coming in and talking. You know, you've just your voice and your whole, like, it makes you want to just give back, you know, and get involved. So thank you.
Thank you.
October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and you can find out more at cancer.org.